Accession number 28355, Reel 5.
Well, thank you for explaining that. And I think you've really answered my question in the sense that when you use the phrase fast jet fighter force, because I assume you can't have people aged 45 flying. What was then Lightnings, I suppose?
Or even before that. But no, but just as an aside, it must have it on the tape somewhere. 2 weeks ago, I got airborne in Eurofighter Typhoon. So you're looking at a 75-year-old fighter pilot.
That must have been a fantastic experience.
Of course it was, yes. But I don't think it should be out of context with this. No, I mean, yeah. It was great fun. I only mentioned it because you were talking about the ages. Yes. So, right, where are we? We've left, leaving Cranwell, are we?
Yes.
I think, yes. There's a lot more one could perhaps say about Cranwell, but I think it's for others. You know, I'm not the best voice on that. I've given a short insight into my perceptions of it. After that, I then went off to Singapore as director of plans and operations at headquarters Far East Command. I went out there in mid-September 1970. And you may remember that surprisingly, the Conservative government had just won an election that summer, and the intention of withdrawing completely from the Far East was changed slightly, and it was intended by the new government to leave a small presence. But the planning to remove Far East Command and the major single service headquarters was well advanced. Because I was going to be out there for 13 months, I finished on the end of October 71. I was able to bring my family with me, which was much appreciated, because if it was under 12 months, I would have been going out there on my own. And this was the first overseas appointment I'd had joined in the early 50s in 20 years, you see, so I was quite chuffed to get this opportunity in Singapore. And the job I had was a particularly interesting one as director of plans and operations in the headquarters, Far East Command. So it was a back to the purple appointment again, because I've been with CDS before. I had a marvellous time out there. I think in the first 6 weeks I was out there, I went with the Commander-in-Chief to Australia, to Hawaii, up to Thailand, back to UK.
Who was the CNC?
A chap called Brian Burnett, Air Chief Marshal Sir Brian Burnett, who incidentally is now 92 or 3. I saw him a few weeks ago. He and his wife Val were very kind to us.
Can you describe the job? What exactly?
Director of Plans and Operations. I think that there weren't many operations, fortunately, but certainly the planning side. We were in the process of completing the withdrawal. And I headed a committee with the three single service headquarters planners. One was putting together all the detail of the withdrawal. There was a fair bit of political interest in all of this too, and Headquarters Far East Command had a political advisor, a chap called Reg Hibbert, who again became a very good friend, but we could have some pretty sparky discussions at times. The whole process of withdrawal had been going on for some time, so in a way I just picked up what had already been largely in principle agreed, and there was more to do with the detail as far as the withdrawal from Singapore was concerned, the Far East Command, and of course setting up the residual units that would stay there. But there was another fairly big aspect of being out there, and that was the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, on which one's Commander-in-Chief and the High Commissioners all had a part to play. And so I would be involved in work with them on that. I'm afraid, you know, that it's too far away now to recall any sort of particular detail.
So you would not be able to recall the extent to which Southeast Asia Treaty Organization was, this may be too strong a word, damaged, harmed, impaired by British withdrawal east of...
Well, I think it would have been very seriously with damage, but because we are continuing to say that, because they keep looking for somebody to give them a message. This is what happens, I'm afraid.
Right. Okay.
Sorry about that. Yes, there had been a fair bit of frisson about that. And of course, we were in the period when Malaysia and Singapore weren't exactly the best of friends either. And so there was always some concern that that could lead to difficulties, which in fact, in my time, it never did. But keeping all these sort of balls in the air, certainly as far as the CNC was concerned, was quite demanding. He did a jolly good job, as far as I could make out. Very nice chap. So, Singapore, nice part of the world to be for a year. When you weren't actually working, you would get out on the water, water skiing. You would get up into Malaysia and watch the turtles laying eggs. It was all very unspoiled then, very compared. I mean, I was out in Malaysia a few weeks ago, and a few times before that, but it's, and indeed Singapore too, they've totally changed. Singapore was just beginning to change when I was there. I'd been out there with Balkans in the earlier 60s, 62 I think, early 63. But they were beginning to build the high-rise hotels down Orchard Road. And it's never stopped. Most of Chinatown's disappeared, and there's something you realize the very last minute that that wasn't the right thing to do. They put preservation orders on the few remaining bits and pieces. I think we've talked about Raffles last time briefly. So I'm afraid it's all rather a long time ago, and I don't think I can recall anything which would be useful.
Well, I will ask this general point then. You were there just 13 months, and you said you had a very happy time there. Instinctively, to me, I would have thought for a serviceman it would not have been a happy time to be wrapping up things, which you were all the time. Your principal task, I think.
Yes,
but in a way,
that had not been an altogether unusual pattern over most of my service career. You know, we've gone through Duncan Sands, as you know, there'll be no more fast jet fighters, it'll all be done by missiles. We've been pulling back in various other parts of the world, Suez, Aden. You know, so in a way, the Gulf States and so on. So shrinkage was very much the sort of backdrop to more or less everything from the time that I joined the services. So in that sense, it didn't strike one as being sort of so outrageous. In fact, in this particular case, the withdrawal had been slightly adjusted so that we would continue to keep a presence east of Suez, with at least somewhat of a token presence. But at least, I think, from a political point of view, with the Malaysians, Australians, New Zealanders, and the Singaporeans themselves, the fact that HMG wasn't just walking away and being a totally absentee member of SEATO, it indicated, you know, that we could reinforce again out there, or at least there was the unwritten presumption. Whether we'd actually ever got around to doing it, I don't know, but certainly, so sort of taking up your general point, withdrawal wasn't such an unusual thing. It was part of a pattern which I'd experienced all my time in the Ministry of Defence, both in my early days when I was with the Air Defence side, and then more recently with Chief of Defence Staff. We were constantly seeing cuts in the budget and cuts in deployments of one sort and another. It's not something that you sort of start jumping up and down and say, this is terrible, because you know, you're there to get on with the job, and that's the job you've been given.
My final question then, before we come back to the UK, well, I assume we do, is Vietnam. Did Vietnam impinge, which was only just over the peak, the Tet Offensive, 68 and all that, it was only just over the peak of the terrible period.
Yes.
Did that impinge at all?
No, and you know, I think when one thinks about it in retrospect, at the time one wasn't busy thinking about Vietnam, where we were. HMG had said the Brits weren't going to get involved. The Australians got involved in a small way, but we, the Brits, weren't. So it's not part of our responsibilities. Certainly, I didn't take any account of it, or have to take any account of it. There was a climate of opinion out there at the time, because HMG had said, Wilson government had said, and as far as I can remember, the Heath government had no intention of getting involved, and the Wilson government had been so absolutely clear cut about not getting involved. I wouldn't say it was a non-event, but it wasn't something which figured in one's day-to-day thinking or planning.
Right, thank you. So we come to October 71.
Yep.
And you bring your family back?
I bring my family back on the knowledge that we were going to go to Akrotiri in January 72. So to get two overseas tour, bang bang, was really rather great. Well, particularly as I'd only had 1 year in Far East Command, I was going to get to 2 years at Akrotiri, so I felt that was fine. And when I got back, I started doing some refresher flying, because I was going to a large airfield, and the station commander there would have to be expected to fly, or certainly this one would want to fly. And so I refreshed on the Vulcan and got my captaincy back on that. And just as I was about finishing that, I got a phone call from the Air Secretary saying that they were having trouble with the airman who was in the PSO to the then Chief of Defence Staff, Peter Hill Norton. And they had to find somebody very quickly. And it looked as though it might be me. Well, that produces a longer face. I didn't particularly want to go back to the job which I'd been doing as a wing commander, and now going to be as an air commodore, because I was being promoted to air commodore on the 1st of January. And their airships had to scratch their heads quite a lot, and eventually they pulled John Nichols from Sasso at it was then still fighter command, I think, or was it left with fighter command? And he went and looked after Peter Hill Norton, and I was allowed to see if I could run a real station. I think the presumption having been that Cranwell wasn't a real station, as far as being a station commander. I'd had too many extra pairs of hands to help me there or to tell me what to do. So I escaped to, or went to Akrotiri in January, and I was there till December 1973. And I took over from a chap called John Stacey, who's now sadly dead. And he said, you'll find, this is it's a very big base. We had two Vulcan squadrons, a Canberra squadron, a Lightning squadron, a Hercules squadron, some helicopters, other aircraft like Argosys. And we were on the east-west route, staging post for all the VC-10s and anything else that was coming through. So it was a 24-hour-a-day airfield. It never closed.
Before we continue with that, Kateri, I must just pick up something you said. When you looked as if you might join Peter Hill Norton, you said, "I pulled a very long face." That I interpret as being you saying, "Well, do I, you know, I'd really rather not do this, or are you really absolutely certain that you do want me to do this?" Is the sort of question you were raising. If I'm right in that, was it the first time that you really, in your career, said, I do or don't want to do something?
No, I wasn't given a choice. Oh, right. I mean, I don't, in those days, one wasn't given a choice. I was told that this could well happen. And then, you know, 48 hours later or whatever, I was told, no, it wasn't going to happen. And it was solved by pulling, because I think John Nichols had only been Sasso at Bentley Priory for a matter of weeks or months. So, you know, he was being short toured to go. I was obviously competent to do the job, but shown I could do as a wing commander, and now the job had elevated in status and rank and so on to being a one-star one. So as far as doing the job was concerned, and I knew Peter Hill Norton, I mean, not everybody's cup of tea, but I think he and I always got on well together. So there was no sort of personality clash at all like that. My concern was that I was getting a marvellous station in Akrotiri, the dream of dreams. There was, I think in those days, the only Air Commodore base, station commander base, everywhere else was group captains. And so if you're going to be a one-star officer, to get that was an enormous sort of a feather in your cap, but, you know, it really was something you wanted to do. So I was concerned, apart from which, you know, everyone was sort of all geared to get back overseas, all your luggage was going, you know, from Singapore to Akrotiri, and the boxes and everything. It was the last thing you wanted to do. So I didn't favour it for a whole series of personal and other reasons, professional reasons. But it wasn't any question in my mind. I don't think it ever occurred to me. I say, I'm sorry, I won't do it. But if I'd said that, so you're not going to Akrotiri either.
No, sorry, that wasn't my suggestion. I just wondered whether, because I often ask officers whether they did attempt to
manipulate their postings. Well, I think, in all honesty, I can say no, I don't think I ever have. I've been disappointed in one set of a way or another, perhaps. Disappointed is only sort of very marginal in the sense that I didn't get it quite as soon as I wanted or move or something like that. Or I would rather not have gone to Cranwell, I suppose, but I learned an awful lot and was very good for me there. So, but, you know, coming out of MOD, I would have liked to have gone to a real flying station, a frontline station. Cranwell was not a frontline station. But at that time, there just wasn't another station I had really to move from. CDS's office, for two reasons. One, I had been promoted, which was very nice, and therefore the job, which was still a wing commander, I'd become a group captain. I could stay there for a few weeks, which is what I did, 3 months, I think. But also, Sam Elworthy was in by then, and the normal procedure on purple appointments is that the Chief of Defence Staff's immediate supporting officer, staff officer, is of another service. When I was CDS, I had a naval PSO. So for that reason, I had to move fairly soon after Sam got in. In fact, I did nearly 6 months with him, and I loved it. I've been very happy to stay there, couldn't stay there because I'd been made a group captain. Although a few months after I went, whoever took over from me collapsed, and then they put a naval captain in there, and then it grew further and became a one-star job, so which was by the time I was being offered it again. So I was dearly very happy about going to Akrotiri. I certainly wouldn't have been happy not to have gone, but of course, you know, if you're told to do something, for in those days, or even now I hope, I would have done it. So anyway, that's just it was one of those things which didn't go wrong, but for a 48 hours or so, it looked painfully as though it might.
Thank you.
And anyway, so Akrotiri, a very big station, as I think I've just outlined. John Stacey, who's the station commander before me, said to me, "You'll find you get an enormous number of visits here. Yeah, there's a sort of run-of-the-mill one, and then there's the sort of one that takes 2 or 3 days to get organized, and then there's the one that stops the station." I can't remember exactly how he bracketed, but that, I can remember the last one, you know, it stops the station, you know, you have to pull out all the stops. And he gave me a list of these, which he'd gone through in his 2 years, and I can't remember the exact figures. But after about 6 or 9 months, and we'd had a busy time, but I didn't think it was excessively busy. I certainly enjoyed it. We'd be descended on by MPs and cabinet ministers, sometimes just passing through, but quite often staying, secretaries of state for defense, and commanders in chief, and this and that, and NATO, you know, all sorts of visitors. And so after about 6 months or so, I said to my staff, dig out that thing which John Stacey gave me and let's run a ruler over and see how we've been doing. And on every one, we were way above what John had sort of been, not complaining about, but commenting on, you know, the tough job he'd had. But I felt very strongly, Akrotiri was, and this is all of the Cold War time, you know, we weren't into operations or anything like that. But you had to sell the Air Force, and Akrotiri was the most marvelous shop window. All those mix of different frontline units, everybody, you know, working very hard, open 24 hours a day, seeing all sorts of types of aircraft through on the way out to the Far East or back, the trooping aircraft, visiting potentates. You know, it was a very good shop window.
Now, apart from the shop window function, which was extremely important, what was its function? What was the need to have these huge? I say huge. I don't know where
Centre. You see, first of all, the Central Treaty Organisation, very important. We had two Balkan squadrons out there committed to nuclear operations. In the event, you know, that we had to go to war. We obviously had an air defense unit. We had transport units. The Canberras were photo reconnaissance. And, we'd lost Idris. We'd lost Malta during the time I was there.
This is the Dom Mintoff thing?
Dom Mintoff thing, yes, Lucca. In fact, we inherited the Canberra Federal Reconnaissance Squadron, 13th Squadron from Malta. Fairly short notice for the squadron, but that was added to our orbit. Anyway, so it was a big base, geographically very important. And of course, the other part of Cyprus is the intelligence gathering side, which I wouldn't even go into, but you know, is there. And so all of that meant that the southern base areas, Akrotiri was. Well, were a critically important part of the overall sort of defence posture, and particularly as we're sort of losing out elsewhere around the Mediterranean. I mean, going back to Suez and then Idris, El Adam. When I say Idris, I mean Libya, El Adam. Idris was one of the airfields, and El Adam was the other in Libya. And of course, we lost out on both of those when Gaddafi came in. And I can't quite remember when that was. I just can't remember.
I can't.
But I certainly was flying Balkans through Libya in the early 60s. And by this time, the early 70s, we had lost the use of those bases. And then in 1973, early 73, I think it was, we lost the use of Lucca. So Akrotiri became more and more important as the footprint base, and there were the usual sort of United Nations problems with the Turks. At that stage, Cyprus still was a single island, but of course it had troubles in the past, and so there was a United Nations force there as well, which I didn't see very much of. Yes,
because I was going to ask. You left in December 73, and within 9 months, of course.
Yeah, the Turks had come in and taken over the northern half of Cyprus.
Yes. And I just wondered whether any of that was, whether you were aware of any difficulties that might come.
No.
You had no planning for that at that stage in your...
No, as far as I was concerned, but then that would be more up at the headquarters than, you know, I was running an airfield and the operations from the airfield. I wasn't running the island or responsible for the island that's left with the Command of British Forces Near East up at Episcopi. So anyway, Akrotiri, a very busy place. It had this nuclear row. It I can remember we scrambled all 16 Vulcans one day. Quite an impressive sight to get the whole lot off. it was, you really felt you were in right at the heart of the front line in the Cold War, admittedly. But it could always got hot. And from there you could, you went to Turkey a little bit. You certainly went into Iran. We used to fly routes down over Iran and then down further into the Gulf and down to into Oman, down at the airfield of the tip, his name escapes me, man. But, so we were getting around quite a bit. That was the time when we also got involved in Bomber Command competitions, and when we were able to wipe the eye of the Bomber Command units back here, or Strike Command units back here. That was a big day for the two Vulcan squadrons, all the crews that achieved that. So, you know, there was a lot going on, which made it a very impressive and lovely place to command.
Yes. Thank you.
So, that was that. I left there in December 73.
You had your family with you, of course.
Family with me. Son was boarding school here, but he could usually get an indulgence flight out at half term, which was as well as the sort of official flights, because there were so many DC-10s coming through from Bryce Norton. So there was nearly always the odd space available. Even enough to get one's car back at the end, in the back of a Hercules, you know, so my brand new or nearly brand new Volvo, which I then had to pay a fair bit of tax on when it arrived at time. anyway, so that was, you know, it was a very enjoyable special time. It was very hard work. I mean, at one stage, I don't think I left the base for 6 weeks. That was really because one's presence it wasn't self-imposed. There was something happening which it was appropriate for the station commander to be there. And so, I mean, well, so I didn't leave the base. I probably went to Lymington or something to do a bit of shopping, but not Limassol, not Lymington. But there were other things that you could do, sailing and water skiing. There were a couple of yachts, and to take them out of there was a very small mole harbour at the eastern end of Akrotiri Peninsula, where these boats were kept, and to sail them across.
All part of the sovereign base.
All part of the sovereign base, too. They were owned by the RAF or the British Forces, they used to sail those across Limassol Bay, go ashore and have a kebab or something, and then sail back. There was a family occasion with one or two other families on board. There were some very, very lovely times there. So, you know, happy memories. But very high. And then, of course, there's a sort of culture side, Hamlet and the amphitheatre. And of course, there's a lot of antiquity too around in Cyprus.
Yeah.
Even more, of course, if you go across to Turkey.
Yes.
You get, take a car and a car ferry across from Famagusta to Mersin and tour around Turkey. Or you could fly into Istanbul and have a 2 or 3 days there.
Which you did.
Which we did, yes. So we also went to Lebanon, went round to Israel on holiday, also went to Jordan. Going to Jordan, you had to go down, you couldn't overfly Israel in those days, so you had to go all the way down. This was a, you know, an RAF flight, which you indulged in. I think we had the squash team or something on board here and play the Jordanian Air Force. But I happened to know the air attaché in Jordan, and he fitted out, he arranged for us to have a Mercedes go down to Petra. And June, my wife, and I were sitting in the back of this Mercedes, sort of enjoying this lap of luxury, with a driver who didn't have any English sitting in the front, with the radio blaring away in some Arabic station. So June and I thought it'd be nice if we could have a bit of peace and quiet. So I tapped him on the shoulder just to ask him if he'd...